They want you gone from here,
Gilliman told me. I suspect he could have used battle sign as readily as he understood it, or even thought mark, but he didn't.
You are an embarrassment for too many people. They want you off to war as quickly as possible, out of sight, out of sensation.
He looked directly at me. Few people ever did that.
I do not want that for you. If Valoris had not recalled you all when he did, I would now be looking for you myself. Combat is the easy part. Construction, that is the challenge.
He was rattling through some prepared offer, I could tell. He had not been lying about the pressure on his scarce time. No doubt he was needed in a dozen other places at that moment. I wish to serve, I signed. That, I concede now, may have been a mistake.
I know, Gilliman said. So I make two requests of you. They are requests, not orders, since you have no formal command structures yet. The first is that you allow me to honour you publicly. I wish to remind this world that it has defenders. The second is that you do not take up the position that has been offered to you, but instead travel to Luna. Your sisterhood citadel is still there, though in what state I do not know. I have appointed a commander again to restore it, and I wish her to have the best working for her. What say you?
Luna. I had not even set eyes on our ancestral home since returning to Terra. The toxic cloud cover here was too permanent, making it easy to imagine that the moon was simply no longer there at all. I hesitated. That was not what I had had in mind.
I hated Terra, and getting away from it, getting as far away as possible, had been at the forefront of my thoughts. I had even wondered whether I might be able to find a way back to Eraser somehow, to see if anything had survived of my old enclave. He was no fool, though, Gilliman. If he was not quite a literal mind reader, then he was perceptive enough to know what mattered to people. I do not know why or how your kind was ever permitted to wither, he said. The answers may never be found, but if any clues remain, they will be there, in the ruins of Somnus.
And that was what did it, of course. He was giving me the chance to uncover answers to questions that refused to go away. And Somnus was not quite on Terra, so that was something. For all I knew, things were different on Luna. I could possibly make a greater mark there. I could help ensure that the mistakes of the past were not repeated. So I said yes. I gave the simplest gesture for the affirmative, and he took it to mean that I acquiesced to both his requests. In truth, though, I only ever agreed to the second offer. Perhaps he had misunderstood my reply, and my subsequently getting wrapped up in that damned ceremony was a genuine mistake on his part. But I don't think he made many mistakes, and as I look back at that brief conversation, it annoys me how expertly he handled me. Primarchs. I remain glad we only have to contend with one of them. He chose to have it on one of the large parade grounds to the south of the Great Tower of Heroes. I could understand why, given his intent. Many of the huge structures overlooking the open space were still damaged from the first prolonged bout of disorder, but the dominating profile of the tower projected a reassuring air of solidity. It rose up into the hazy skies like a jutting spear of black granite, cracked with age, the many stone figures on its six sides, worn smooth and featureless. At the summit, lost in the drifting smog, was the Bell of Lost Souls itself, mercifully silent for the time being. He had worked hard to make the place look the part. Titans stood in ranks across the parade ground, their guns draped with battle standards, their hunchbacked torsos leaking smoke. Infantry squares from hundreds of Astra Militarum units stood to attention, flanked by the growl of their idling armor columns. Banners swayed from the balconies of every building,
all depicting some great victory of the past age. Sigismund the Champion was there, picked out in gold thread on heavy iron-weighted cloth. Sanguinius was there too, predictably, shown in a dazzling array of iconic, ministorum-approved presentations. Military music blared from stacked voximeters, making the air shake and the dust underfoot shift. At the foot of the tower, a grand stage had been erected. Even from a distance it looked spectacular, clad in golden plate and diamond-studded finials, its high roof fluted with Gothic detail, its crown surmounted by the symbols of the Adeptus Terror and Ultramar. Squads of many space marines stood in chapter formation around it, all of them as static and imposing as stalagmites. Ministers of the church roved everywhere, spraying incense from hovering pump guns, swinging heavy reliquaries, roaring out hymns of praise to the returned Primarch and his Eternal Father. There must have been hundreds of thousands assembled there, packing every square metre of rockcrete, arranged into disciplined regiments and battalions, a perfect snapshot of the Imperial war machine in all its varied splendour. Squadrons of atmospheric fighters shot overhead, releasing airbursts of golden flak as they went, followed by coordinated flights of Imperial Navy gunships. Linked picked emitters piped every choreographed sequence into the communal viewing chambers of every HAB unit on the planet. Every speech was recorded as it took place, immediately transcribed onto parchment and data wafer, before being shunted off to the transport hubs for rapid off-world distribution. Gilliman wanted this scene. He wanted it heard. There would be few opportunities for him to gather his forces again in a place where such wide dissemination would be possible, and so the opportunity had to be taken while the chance remained. I have to admit, the effect was impressive. Even I, as cynical a soul as had ever worn Imperial armour, found myself a little stirred by the sights before me. I saw the parade of heroes, those who had fought at the Lion's Gate, as I had, as well as those who had smashed their way here from Ultramar, all of them carrying their wounds and their battle damage proudly, and felt my withered heart beat a little faster. I saw the sheer magnitude of what had been gathered, and began to wonder, dangerously, whether some kind of revival might be possible after all. The tower above us had existed for eternity, as far as I knew. Its bell had tolled many thousands of times, and would toll again. But it was still guarded, still tended, and that counted for something. The gathered hosts listened attentively to the many sermons and speeches, all of them amplified from the stage by the banks of vox emitters. Generals gave orations on the infinite power of the Astra Militarum and its inexhaustible numbers. And admirals told us just how many new battleships were rolling off the production lines on 100 forge worlds, all destined to take the fight back to the enemy. So far, that was little different to the endlessly rotated stuff found on Ministorum and Departmentum Unitorum propaganda reels, albeit backed up by some spectacular visuals. But then, the Primarch took to his feet, and the crowd roared. And I mean they roared. The noise was astonishing, rising unbidden, voluntarily from mouths that were used to being clamped shut from fear. There was an edge to that huge noise, a slight flavour of desperation. You sensed, somehow, that if the Space Marines had not been there, or if the stage had not been cordoned by multiple layers of flay wire and auto-turrets, they might have rushed the podium then, desperate to get closer to the Protector, in whom so much had been invested. Gilliman strode up to the Aquila-proud lectern. Its gaudy bulk thrust high, towering over the massed regiments, and the light glinted sharply from his armour. It was not Terra's grey sunlight, of course. Powerful lumen beams had been artfully arranged to converge on him, making the metallic swirls over his cobalt plate
blaze, almost painfully. He moved in a nimbus of gold and silver, his limbs blurred by it. His face swam across every screen stack, flawless and stone hard. His expression was exactly the same as it was in his sanctioned images. Resolute, calm, unyielding. He gripped the edge of the lectern, leaned forward, and began to speak. I do not remember much of what he said. Perhaps others do, intent on recalling every part of it, so that they might tell their children and grandchildren of the time they listened to the words of a living God on the holy ground of Terra. I was too busy marvelling at the effect he had on them. The roar fell away to perfect silence. Even the Titan engines seemed to still, stalling in reverence. They all looked to him. Thousands and thousands of hopeful eyes, fixed laser-like on that single point. Beyond the parade ground, I knew billions more would be riveted, huddled around their tiny vid screens, squinting hard at the rusted images and straining to catch the hissing audex. I do remember the climax of his oration, though. That was where he took hold of his intent. Not merely to recover lost ground, but to strike out beyond that, turning defeat into victory, just as he had done in the Age of Wonder.
Indomitus, he cried.
I think that was the first time it had been named that, at least in public.
The crusade that reconquers, burning the enemy from our worlds as disease is burned from the body. I shall not rest. I shall not pause. I shall strike them where they stand. I shall strike them as they flee. I shall lay their walls low. I shall break open their gates. None shall be spared, and none shall be forgiven. And if any ask you what you should feel towards those who have brought this war to us, I say that you should be thankful. Be thankful that you live in these times when our long slumber has ended, and we can rise up and remember that we are strong.
It was impossible not to be affected by that. Perhaps the response was more profound for those with souls, but even I found myself imagining the crusade as he pictured it for us, thundering out into the void with his flaming sword at its head. I found myself imagining that he could win. It was a suggestive, perilous thought. After that, the rest of it passed in something of a blur. Gilliman honoured those who had fought hardest with him on the road to Terra. One by one, the heroes of his journey were brought forward, each to ecstatic bellows from the crowd. Many were space marines, whom I imagined cared nothing for the adulation of the masses, but understood what Gilliman was doing and played their part accordingly. Then came the recognition for the Lion's Gate, and, with a sudden spike of recognition, I saw Valerian walk up to the podium, clad in his restored armour. It was the first time I had seen him since Vorlees. He went helmless, and I caught a glimpse again of that starkly handsome face, serene and untroubled by the extravagant theatre around him. He bore scars now, though. Wounds from cursed blades that I guessed would never properly heal. He had sent me messages during my recovery, asking to meet. I had ignored them all, not because I did not wish to see him again, but because, and I cringe now to recall it, I was not ready. I did not want him to see me weak, and I did not know how it would make me feel to be reunited with him after coming so close to death in his company. You may think this foolish. Remember, though, that we are not used to the kindness of others. We are used to being shunned. After a while it becomes easier to expect that, and correspondingly difficult to deal with anything else. Valerian was a strange character, one whose basic lack of human understanding made him oddly attuned to our own distinctiveness. He was not repelled by us, because in many ways he was not repelled by anything. He just was. Nothing more, nothing less. And that was sometimes hard to deal with. So I watched him, as all the others watched, as a spectator. I saw Gilliman crown him with the laurel wreath taken from Ultramar, one that rose from his armour like curled eagle's wings. Valerian was named a hero of the Lion's Gate, an ancient honour taken from the only other time in history that the bastion had come under attack. Once the wreath had been affixed, an odd combination of Adeptus Astartes livery with his older Adeptus Custodes armour profile, Valerian turned to face the assembled hosts. Bathing for a moment in adulation that I do not suppose for a moment he truly understood. And then it was my turn. I walked up the steps, clad also in my reconditioned armour, feeling the blaze of lumens on me, wafted by that rolling sonic wall of cheering. The Primarch gazed down at me and took up a longsword in both hands. I recognised the mark at once. An executioner great blade, just like the one destroyed on the hellship, but far finer. It was old. Its antiquity bled from it, just as it did from him, and I knew without being told that the weapon came from his own age. "The Somnus blade," he said, offering it to me. "Once born by..." "Do not tell me," I warned him. "You've already given me too much to live up to." He smiled. As I took the sword, feeling its weight, he looked up. For a moment, I saw his upturned face bathed in hard light, and at such closeness, the flaws and blemishes on that toughened skin were visible. He was mortal, after all. He was a man, or like a man. Limited by time and space. Just by being there next to him, I was party to the deception. I was on the stage with him, sharing the adulation of the distant throng, projecting an image of ineffable strength. And yet, like the platform we stood on, the gold facade was sliver thin, the foundations crude and hastily put together. He had let me get that close. So perhaps he didn't care that I saw the truth of it all. Or perhaps he too had been seduced by his own rhetoric. I turned, just as Valerian and all the others turned, and we faced the multitudes. I do not know what the others all thought, watching the euphoric display. My own feelings were mixed. I could see the sense in it all. I could see how it would help heal recently cut wounds. But it was all so fragile. I stole a glance at Valerian. As ever, his expression was virtually unreadable. So I looked back out. I soaked up the adulation. On any other day, those people would have avoided eye contact with me. Made a protective sign, hissed a curse, or turned away in disgust. Now they were cheering. "Enjoy it while you can," I told myself. "It can't last."
Chapter 4. Jek. You will forgive, I hope, the density of detail here while I try to explain the situation that confronted us once he was gone. I shall not weary you with its full complexity. Like all histories, this is, of course, a simplification, but just a little explanation here at the start will be required. For 10,000 years, a sole institution, composed of just 12 men and women, had governed the Imperium. The High Lords of Terra had, across the many generations, been charged with all the great decisions of state, guiding our species through its many trials and challenges. No greater power existed within the many layers of the Adeptus Terra. The High Lords themselves were always regents, always stewards, operating as intermediaries between us and he who eternally guides us from his golden throne, attempting to divine his will through speculation, scholarship, the utilization of prayer, or the tarot. None challenged them, for all that. Regents they may have been, but they behaved like kings. Now the situation had changed. Less than 4 months after our short meeting in his chambers, and just after staging his great ceremony of renewal, Gilliman left Terra. It was he now who interpreted the will of the Emperor. As well as becoming the Lord Commander of the Imperium's military forces, he also took up the mantle of Imperial Regent. The High Lords had been used to serving a silent god. They now served a living man. I think even they were slow to realize just what that meant. The most immediate implication was the change in personnel. Gilliman had lost no time in imposing his will on the Senatorum, knowing that while he was fully occupied in matters of war, he would need reliable legates on Terra to keep the business of government in operation. He had spoken to all of them, individually. Of the original 12, 5 were replaced, one as a result of death, the other 4 as a result of Gilliman's command. The highest profile casualty was Urthu Himatalian, the old master of the Administratum. He had been the most powerful of the old 12, and one of the longest serving. In the immediate aftermath of the catastrophe striking us, he had argued most powerfully for the policy of retrenchment, ordering the cessation of even short-range void traffic while the Astronomicon was down. Had that edict been strictly observed, we would have lost the Vorlees Gate, thus delaying the Indominus Crusade for many years. For that misjudgment alone, he was liable for removal. But there were other marks against his character. He was a leading member of what was known in the palace as the Static Tendency, the position that the Imperium's constitution had been proven to be perfect by a clear understanding of historical law and theology, and that any attempt to fundamentally change the established settlement amounted to treason against the Emperor himself. Himatalian would never have agreed to even Gilliman's more tentative reforms, and so was removed from office with immediate effect. With him went Ila Lama, the Paternoval envoy, Carnia Danda, the speaker of the Chartist captains, and Baldo Slist, the ecclesiarch. Lama departed for reasons that eluded me. She had been a supporter of my old master's attempts to bring the Adeptus Custodes into active service again, and in fact had gone further than most in arguing for wholesale revisions to the laws that governed us. Perhaps that had been her error. She might have been too enthusiastic. Gilliman, after all, had been the author of the Codex Astartes, as well as many other elements of the Lex Imperialis, and had no desire to effect full-scale revolution, just make the changes he deemed necessary to ensure survival. Slist, by contrast, was one of the strictest adherents of the Static Tendency I had ever met. He was an impulsive man, one for whom the narrowest interpretation of the Emperor's will was the only tolerable one. Given his temperament and influence over the sprawling church, like Himatalian, he could not possibly have remained in place. Danda continued as speaker, but Gilliman decided that the council needed to be orientated more closely towards military rather than civilian matters. As a result, she ceased to be counted as a High Lord, and withdrew to her fortress at the Nexus Axiomatic to rebuild the trade networks that had been so badly damaged by the psionic upheaval during the beacon's outage. After those 5 departures came 5 new arrivals. The new master of the Administratum was Violetta Roskavla, who had previously headed the Departamento Munitorum. She had a reputation as a logistic genius, suitably enough given her past role, and had been chosen to ensure that the Indomitus Crusade was kept fully supplied. She was not thought to be overtly political, which reflected, I suppose, the new military direction of the council. She was not a native of Terra either, hailing instead from the ice and fire world of Inuit, though that meant relatively little in an Imperium of a million planets. From what I knew of her, I liked her. She was level-headed and hard-working. I wondered if she had the temperament for the snake pit of the Senatorum, but that could only be proved by surviving it, and so I was prepared to give her the benefit of the doubt. Alongside her, the new master of the Astronomicon was Lucius Throde, taken from Kera Pleiades' staff at the Adeptus Astra Telepathica and given the daunting task of setting the Forbidden Fortress in order. The new ecclesiarch was Eos Retira, whom Gilliman had brought with him from Ultramar, and who was seen as a reformer. The new Paternoval envoy was Kadak Mir, who, just as always, was something of a cipher for the true masters of the ancient navigator houses. Of the greatest interest to me, however, was Damda's replacement. Mar-Av Ashariel was the Lord Commander Militant of the Astra Militarum, a position that had always been exceptionally powerful, but with elevation to the High Council became even more influential. The motivation was self-evident. The bulk of the Indomitus Crusade's fighting strength would be supplied by the Guard, so it was clearly advantageous to have their advocate at the highest table of them all. Once the dust had settled on the changes, I was left to ponder three main conclusions. The first was that the balance of power on the Council was now firmly with the various branches of the Imperial military. It was clear that Terra had been ordered to serve the Crusade, not the other way around. The second was that the static tendency had been weakened, but not eradicated. Some surviving members of the Council, such as the Grand Provost Marshal and the Grand Master of Assassins, were known to be static sympathizers, which demonstrated the difficult balancing act between factions Gilliman was attempting to pull off. Third, the newcomers were in many cases inexperienced politicians, at least in contrast to their incumbent counterparts, and so would have a steep learning curve ahead of them if they were to hold their own amid the poisoned scheming of the Senatorum's power games. My only desire was to help them. I had no particular agenda of my own, other than to see the Council return to full effectiveness. I was one of those many thousands of adepts whose life and purpose was wholly bound up in the Great Machine, as we called it, the towering bureaucracy of the mighty Imperial edifice. We were advisers, scholars, enablers, and functionaries, trained to adhere to the letter of the law and never to exceed it. That principle is so easy to state, and yet in practice, so hard to achieve. I had observed Tyrion's conduct over the many prior decades, and occasionally balked at his choices, particularly when he pushed a specific policy of his own, or leaned hard on someone to get something done. Now, having been placed into the same position, I understand a little more why he made such decisions. Impartiality is a terrible position to maintain, like walking along a narrow ridge between chasms on either side. It would have been difficult enough in normal times, but now we were beset by unprecedented gales, liable to be thrown from our footholds and sent tumbling one way or the other. I knew I needed to act swiftly to secure my position and strike out for what I wanted. I sat down with Mordecai, and we pored over the biographies of those we now served, and considered what we knew and what we didn't. Gilliman's words to me still resounded in my mind. The reforms had been enacted, and now I had to maintain them. Some were already calling this the Reform Council, as if its place in the history tomes were already assured.
"We must move alongside the new blood,"
Mordecai said, grudgingly. He didn't at all like the idea that there was new blood.
"Make ourselves indispensable."
He was right, but I had to choose my path carefully. I could not be seen to be showing favour to one side or the other. I did not yet command Tyrion's dense webs of obligation and patronage, and so had to rely on persuasion and argument, always the weakest of the tools at our disposal. "We're underprotected," I said, studying piles of ledgers sent to me by my scholiasts. The ramparts are empty. The anarchy is getting worse. It can't be allowed to continue. Mordecai looked up at me.
Then you've decided who to see first,
he said. I have, I said, getting up. Wish me luck. It took a long time to secure a meeting. There were lots of possible reasons for this. The Senatorum was still in a state of disarray. The new High Lords were still moving their extensive staffs to their assigned offices. Communications were still patchy. Or perhaps he just didn't want to see me. High Lords, in my experience, were always prickly characters. They had no time for fools or weaklings. Their every decision governed the lives of billions, and that level of responsibility made them, at the very least, hard to deal with. You had to look them in the eye, show them you meant business, never give off an air of undue deference or slackness of will, or they would run you over. So I kept at it. I never went to him in person, but always sent subordinates, not intending to devalue the office I held by begging. Eventually, having made it clear that I was not going away, I received the acceptance I was after. Terse agreement, signed by a junior adept and transmitted over an unsecured channel. That was a slight, but one that could be ignored for the moment. He would have to learn, over time, that the Council relied on its advisers, and that without us, nothing much could ever be achieved. I wore my formal robes of office, together with the heavy Aquila chain that Tyron, in his final years as Chancellor, had rarely bothered with. I took a grav barge over to his fortress, perched up on the high northern escarpments of the outer wall. The buildings there were heavy-set, bleak, made to weather orbital strikes. Every aspect of them was military, from the utilitarian profile of the high ramparts to the heavy drone presence in the skies above. Our barge was challenged several times on the inbound flight and shadowed all the while by fast-attack flyers bristling with shock cannons. It was late in the day by the time we were given clearance to enter the main hangars, and by then, dark grey skies scudded overhead. The worst of the psi storms had abated at that stage, and we had all become used again to the steady heat and humidity of the punishing Terran climate. Air traffic had returned, following the short hiatus during the major riots, and our BT's units were still out in large numbers. But there was a tension there, nonetheless, one that the Grand Parades had only temporarily eclipsed. I looked out at the darkening spires, many still charred and smouldering, and saw a tense world ready to ignite again. We were escorted inside the hangar's interior by no less than 6 Axis hunter-killer flyers. Once my barge had set down, I gathered my robes about me and made my way down the ramp to be greeted by a delegation of Militarum officers. The most senior of them was a regimental captain, a man in a khaki dress uniform and a black half-cloak. Now, that really was insulting.
"Greetings, Lord Chancellor,"
he said, making the sign of the Aquila.
"Captain Slef Derim at your service. The High Lord awaits you within."
I stood before him. I looked him slowly up and down. "Protocol demands reception by colonel rank or greater," I said crisply. "Next time, ensure he sends someone appropriate." Derim stiffened a little, but I gave him no chance to reply, whether it was to protest or apologize, and set off. We walked in silence from the hangar to the High Lord's chambers. It was a long journey, and the captain seemed to find it awkward. No doubt he was used to dealing with subordinates who ran to obey his orders. I remained relaxed. This was just a little game, the kind we all had to indulge in at the start. We reached our destination, and Derim withdrew. I was escorted to the High Lord's personal chambers by civilian adepts in black robes. We reached a pair of high steel doors, both bearing the engraved sigil of the Astra Militarum. These opened as we approached, and I was shepherded inside. The chamber beyond was large and old. It had seen better days, and its long-term occupants were not the sort to worry over much about decoration. It looked much as I imagine a command bunker would look on a planetary battlefield, lined with hololith generators and banks of comms equipment. A row of battle standards hung along one wall, all furled with golden chains. Granite eagles' heads jutted out from the chamber's interior walls. Everything was impeccably clean, though utilitarian. Mar-Av Asharial was standing in front of a great rockcrete desk, arms folded, looking as solid and unlovely as the rest of the room's contents. He wore the black-green dress uniform of his old regiment, the Cathartes Arenas, one of the fabled Old Hundred of Terra. A line of iron medals was pinned across his taut chest, and a saber with an ebony hilt hung at his waist. He was short, powerfully built, with a thick neck and close-shorn white hair. "My lord," I said, nodding my head by a fraction. He grunted. I could see a coin being passed from one finger to another within a clenched fist. I wasn't sure why he was doing that. Perhaps to display how little importance he placed on this meeting. "I trust you have been given the assistance you require," I said, "since taking your high office."
"Nothing works," he said.
His voice was snapped and tight, made hoarse by years of bawling into voxes under fire.
"The place is a shambles."
I settled myself for a grueling encounter. "You will appreciate that we have been operating under duress these last few months. Things will improve."
"They had better,"
he said. He unfolded his arms.
"So, what do you want here, Chancellor? I'm busy. In case it had slipped your mind, a crusade is in progress."
"I would not have troubled you were it not important." He was still toying with that damned coin. I felt like grabbing it from him. "Seldom has a High Council contained as many new members as it does now. We face the greatest threat to our existence we have known since the Great Heresy, and the resources available to us are scarcer than I can ever remember. You are used to field command, Lord, but you may not be familiar with how things operate here. I come to offer you my assistance. You must remember that the capabilities of me and my staff are at your disposal." Asharial looked at me blankly. I began to wonder how acute he really was. He had a reputation for tactical brilliance, but perhaps that meant little when the lasbolts weren't flying.
"I have my own staff," he said.
"Yes, I know. But this is Terra." I folded my own arms, keeping my Aquila chain in view. "I will be frank. I am concerned about the pace of change. This world is still only half-governed. We are out of contact with much of the Southern Hemisphere, and large areas within comm range remain under dubious control. That is unconscionable. This is the throne world, and we barely have mastery of it." He looked like he wished to interject, but I kept talking. "If things were otherwise, we would be pulling regiments back from a dozen sectors to put these fires out. But we cannot, because the Lord Gilliman has taken them all with him. There are those on the council who remain relaxed about this, but I do not share their confidence. You have a reputation as a prudent man, my lord. I suspect you are also unconvinced." Asharial grunted again. His body projected an air of astonishing immobility, as if the entire bastion might subside into rubble around him and he would still be there, ugly and objectionable.
"Indomitus has been launched,"
he said, the tone of his voice unchanged.
"A 1,000 regiments from 1,000 worlds are being mobilized. All naval assets from here to Vigilus are requisitioned for troop transfer. My comm staff take 100 messages every hour from every backwater world you and I have never heard of, all demanding arms and armor. That is the reality. That is the priority."
"For the Imperium, no doubt," I said. "But that only matters if the center holds." I looked over at the rows of standards he kept furled. There are many battles, some of them easier to spy than others. There is a struggle for our soul here, right under our noses. And that occupies me just as much as the battlefronts of the void.
These things are your concern.
No, I said, turning back to him. They are yours. That is the point. I tried to find the right words to convince him. Listen to me. The regent has made great changes. Some have been welcomed, some will be resisted. Some see him as the saviour of our age. Others wish he had never come back. Now he has gone again. Those battles will only grow, and they will take place here, on a world that is bruised and bleeding and ripe to lapse back into anarchy. If an enemy wished to unravel all he has done, then they would make use of that. He was listening to me, I'll give him that, albeit skeptically. All eyes are turned to the stars. I understand that. But if we do not make the masses here feel secure again, then you will lose their trust. And with it, the council. He sniffed.
I never cared for the opinion of the masses.
You were a soldier then. Now you are a minister to the throne. I might have imagined it, but I thought he winced at that, just a little. Maybe he had taken the position out of duty, and would have preferred his old life of rations, transports, and underground bunkers.
State what you want, then,
he said gruffly.
Plainly.
3 more full-strength regiments of Astra Militarum here landed on world to reinforce what is already garrisoned, I said. A subsector-level battle group in strike-ready orbit. Joint command centers established at each planetary nexus. Terra placed under general edict of control. He smiled. It was not a pleasant thing to witness.
And what battlefront would you pull these forces from, Chancellor?
I looked him in the eye. That is for you to decide, my lord, I said. You give the commands. I made the calculation that Ashariel was a man who enjoyed being stood up to. Such a man, in my estimation, would treat with an equal while disdaining a subordinate. Flattery would have little effect, and threats none at all. There had always been the chance I was wrong.
What you ask for is impossible,
Ashariel said, his brief smile dying.
Terra has its own protectors.
I was still looking him in the eye. They will not be enough, I said. He looked right back at me.
Things have changed now, Chancellor. Others, yourself included, must begin to learn what that means.
Think on it. I urge you.
I have done.
There was a cold pleasure there, I think, in those porcine eyes.
For generations, the High Lords have treated the Guard as infinitely expendable. We were sacrificed in our billions for Terra. Now, a general has arrived, worthy of service, who takes the fight to the enemy, not just to hold them back, but to defeat them. If this world were emptied, its cathedrals silenced, its hives stripped bare, that would still be victory. Do you understand me, Chancellor? I care nothing for this planet. The fates of 1 million other worlds are my concern now.
I had not expected that. The High Lords had ever squabbled and schemed, but always over the same prize. Now, it seemed, there was no longer what they coveted most of all. There were greater objectives, greater dangers, greater games. Perhaps Ashariel was right. Perhaps I needed to learn what all of this meant. You cannot believe that, I said. But I failed to make the statement bite. He turned away.
Go now, Chancellor,
he said dismissively.
Find another target for your intrigues. I have a crusade to run.
Chapter 5. Valerian. It would be called the Argent Chamber. I do not know who styled it thus. It was not me. A simple name by our standards, and one that carried little enough weight with it. I suspect that was the purpose, to blend into the many thousands of other factions and cadres and operational groups of the Aquilan Shield, so that if records were ever kept of what we had done, then they might be overlooked or forgotten quickly. These were the times in which we now lived. For our order's entire history, we had been loosely organized. Our formations were fleeting things, in general, put together in order to counter specific threats, then dissolved or changed. We were too individual to fight alongside one another in rigid battalions, and our hierarchy was not deep. The Argent Chamber was one of many dozens of detachments I had served in over the long years, and I did not expect it to last much longer than any of the others. I was to be its leader, a shield captain, just as I had been for a very long time. Those serving with me, six warriors taken from a number of other chambers, were mostly unfamiliar. I had fought alongside our Vexillus Praetor on one previous occasion, during an encounter that I shall not name here. His name was Ravathane, and I admired his skill with a sentinel blade. He spoke softly and had gentle features, but there was a darkness extant in his blade play, as if in that action he felt free to discharge an aspect of himself that was normally kept suppressed. If so, I did not disapprove of the principle. In combat, we were freer than at any other time. Many of us used killing as a rare moment of expression amid a life of near unrelenting duty. I had done so myself on the Heartspite, and felt that I would do so again. The names of the other five were Halion, Anunnaster, Cleus, Zamander, and Penjard. I looked into their faces at our first meeting, and I saw the flawless lines of their features set in deep ebony, or soft amber, or porcelain white. Each had been taken from a different sodality, plucked from short-lived ties of comradeship, and placed into a new vessel of command. They would bring little with them other than themselves. They would carry no badges of allegiance or icons of triumph, only their names, their deeds, their perfect memories. We spoke together that night in one of the many ancient chambers of the tower. The candles were lit, making our armor glint with wavering smudges of amber gold. We told one another what we had done when the foulness had come to Terra. It had become a habit among us to recount our deeds in that singular hour. Perhaps, shorn of so much else, it was a way to bind ourselves together. I learned that Cleus had been within sight of the Primarch for much of the fighting. I learned that Zamander was the only survivor of his shield company, the Emerald Clave. I learned that Penjard had taken a wound so grievous that for many days after the battle his fate had seemed likely to lead him to the Moritoi, and that Halion and Anunnaster had, by chance or providence, both been stationed on the mid-right flank of the main advance, and thus had been honoured to march alongside Trajan Valoris once the back of the enemy had been broken. As for myself, I told them what I had done, even though I guessed they knew it already. I was a hero of the Lion's Gate, after all, gifted the laurel wreath in honour of my deeds there and afterwards. I took no pride and felt no shame as I spoke. I told it fairly, recalling the part played by Justicar Alcuin and his brothers, as well as that played by Tanal Alea and her sisters. As the words left my mouth, I remembered how it had been, with the fires bursting like oil from the ground under our feet, red and angry as heart's blood, the demon kind screaming. If I closed my eyes, I might have been back there again, under the shadow of the beast. The world seemed a little greyer after that. It seemed a little chillier with the vivid horror of it drained away. Like mortals blinking after looking into the sun, we had to readjust now, calibrate our reality against a different yardstick. All of us knew our duty. The throne world had been wounded deep. Millions had been slain or scattered, causing widespread anarchy across all urban sectors. The opening of the Great Rift had affected this place more acutely than many worlds, despite our physical distance from its epicenter, because the rift was a creation of the ether, and Terra was anchored in the other realm more deeply than any other world inhabited by humanity. Those gifted with sight had been blinded, and those sensitive to the currents of the unseen ocean had been shrived. Disorder still reigned, and that could not be allowed to continue. "We have a name now," I told them. "The Splintered." The term had come to us from the many agents we still had scattered throughout the straggling, smouldering conurbations. Things had become perilous for them, and many had ceased reporting. But we still had a damaged net of spies, harried and isolated, but doing their duty as we had trained them. "Supposition," I said. "The shock of the rift birthed many cults and rebellions, driven by the madness of the breach. These were phenomena of the event, and were contained. But the enemy is on his way, this we know. So there will be others now, planned with greater precision, designed to cause longer-term weakness." They listened. They knew this. We were rehearsing the reasons for our actions, just as we often did, saying the name of the cause and the quarry before we raised our blades against it. The splintered are one such group, or I should say groups. They are diffused by design. We believe many cults take the name, some that don't know what it means, others who do, and these are working towards a single objective. What is that? We can assume. They wish to harry us, keep us busy. They wish to disrupt, to prevent this world from recovering its equilibrium again. If Terra is unstable, the Imperium is unstable. Ravathane looked at me intently. "Then the Imperium should look to them," he offered. I knew what he meant. Before Volis, I might have said the same. Our task back then had been limited, to protect the palace, to hunt only those threats that led directly to the chamber of the throne itself. Now, though, we had been given license for more. My actions had played a small part in that, it was true, but the change had already been coming. Everything was connected now. Every node bled into every other node, a process driven by our weakness in the face of the coming enemy. Or perhaps Ravathane merely meant that this quarry was beneath us. We had faced the demonkin of the Great Unraveling, and so it was natural to see any other enemy as unworthy of our attention. In that, too, I had some sympathy. "The Regent has charged us with this task," I said, and immediately regretted the choice of words. Ravathane was far too composed to give much away, but I was not a fool. I knew that accepting the laurel had not been received with enthusiasm by all my comrades. I would be seen as Gilliman's creature, whatever the truth of the matter. But we had become a prideful order. Perhaps that had always been the way of us, but it seemed to me that we could not afford much pride in this current age. I am sure that long ago a custodian would have scorned the honours of a Primarch, knowing that we were made for a higher purpose than the one they represented. In Gilliman, though, I saw a great hope for renewal. If that meant swallowing some of that infinite pride, just to give him the symbols he needed, then I was prepared to do it. It did not make me his creature. I was no one's creature, save for the one who had made us. "And the Captain General?" asked Ravathane. "He is in agreement," I said. Ravathane nodded. Knowing that Valoris was behind the order seemed to be enough. You may think this exchange a mild one, hardly worthy of mention. For us, though, used to millennia of uncomplicated service, it felt close to outright dissent. We were having to adapt, having been dragged into the open by circumstance, and there was uncertainty here. "If Terra remains in turmoil, the throne cannot be protected," I went on, reinforcing the essential point. "That is the calculation. Too few remain to quell these fires, and so we must do so. It is honourable work, and even if it were not, duty compels us to obey." "Then you have a target in mind," said Ananasta, the one with the porcelain white skin. "I do," I said. We took the Talion gunship out of the palace. The vehicle was one of our smaller transports, capable of carrying the seven of us, but with little room for more. This one, Rustava, had seen action during the Lion's Gate incursion, and still bore the scars of it. It had undergone extensive reconditioning, including ritual purification of its systems, but its golden lines were still blackened. It took some time for us to make our way through the walls. Security in the palace was ratchet tight, fueled by a paranoia that had been slow to ebb. We were challenged by sentinels from our own order, as well as tracked by the scanners of a dozen others. The Grey Knights of Titan had left members of their brotherhood within the inner palace, and though their presence was hidden from most, we knew when they were watching us. No doubt, senior members of the Inquisition were monitoring air traffic closely too, as were the standing armies of Palatine Sentinels and Lucifer Blacks, in addition to the very highest echelons of the Adeptus Arbites. So many factions and clades, all overlapping, all watching, all with their fingers on the trigger. I left Ravathane to respond to any hails worthy of our attention, and studied the view from the four portals. Once through the heavily armoured main walls, passing through the strobing flicker of long exit tunnels, where ranks of suppression gunships hung in their launch cages, we emerged into the familiar brown-grey haze of Terran daylight. I remembered how it had looked to me right at the start of this upheaval, before the demons had come. Then the lines of hablocks had been grim in their sheer immensity, stretching for unbroken kilometre after kilometre. The settlements and slums had seemed grotesquely eternal, a monument to stasis, something that could never be shaken, let alone broken. Now those ranks were marred, marked by gaping holes like scurvied gums. Even so high up I could smell the acrid stench of burning, the mark of low-level fires still murmuring away across the surface. The air traffic was a fraction of what it had been. Most of the vehicles aloft were heavily armoured and moving in guarded convoys. Formations of lightning fighters prowled at high altitude, punching long contrails through the churning cloud cover. I could see gouges at ground level clearly, whole avenues, first levelled by wildfires and then by fighting, before all was bulldozed in the aftermath to deny cover to a resilient and elusive enemy. In the very first days of the insurrections, of course, we had not even known who the enemy truly was. Some were cults of the lost and damned, seeded over long years before lying dormant. Others were nests of the Neverborn, erupting spontaneously as the waves of psychic energies washed across the world. The incursion at the Lion's Gate had only been the largest such infestation, and we could not be certain that they had all been eradicated even now. Since recovering, I devoted myself to the study of the stabilization efforts. I had seen effective campaigns retake significant sectoral zones, and I had seen debacles in which inexperienced commanders had led entire battalions into destruction. Some terrain was secured, only to dissolve into armed conflict as soon as the Council's eyes moved to the next objective. Terra's unique geography hampered all efforts. The close press of buildings, many ruined or in perilous condition, slowed advances and bogged down resupply and communications. The grand avenues were all overlooked by hundreds of windows, many harbouring snipers, and the transitways were blocked by burned-out piles of ground cars. Millions still huddled within the lightless hive shells, we knew, desperate for water and rations. Some such communes were harmless, hoping only for rescue from the nightmares that stalked the shadows. Others were new forged traitors, their diseased bodies strapped with fragmentation charges or poison gas canisters. Telling the difference was a challenge. The Ark's doctrine, only repealed by Gilliman himself on his return from Forlis, had been effective at keeping the central administrative zones intact during the worst of the anarchy. The price we paid was the surrender of vast areas, most of little strategic value, but encompassing millions of souls. Within those sensor-dark regions, who knew what fresh plagues were being incubated, ready to lurch into the open and threaten our citadels once again? We knew that we ourselves, the custodians, were too few to make a decisive difference. We had suffered our own heavy losses during the incursion. Many more of our kind had taken to the void, either with Gilliman on his crusade, or dispatched on critical missions of their own. The greater part of our number remained deep within the Senatorum Imperialis, serving in the role we had taken ever since the days of the Great Heresy, the Watchers of the Throne, static, resolute, invisible. That left few of us to attend to the dissolution beyond the walls, and so we had to select those points where we could be of most use, spearheading precision strikes against the greatest concentrations of cultist activity, or launching raids against the suspected Cabal leaders. Intelligence had led us to the Gorgantha subsector, a semi-industrial zone that had been lost to comms during the blackouts. It was an important manufacturing hub, lodged between close-packed habitation regions, one that churned out finished foodstuffs and domestic items from the raw commodities brought in by macro transporter.